Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is not an exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. In just over a week's time, world leaders and climate negotiators will gather in Glasgow, Scotland for the 26th United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP26. This is a critical moment in global efforts to tackle climate change. With this year's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change saying urgent action is required if global temperature rises are to be kept at 1.5 degrees Celsius. But as we approach the summit, there have been some worrying signs. With the COVID-19 pandemic still posing major risks and disrupting travel, attendance is challenging for leaders of smaller nations in particular, including those of the Pacific. Leaked documents in the host country, the United Kingdom, have revealed a split between Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, over the costs of zero carbon economy. The Biden administration in the United States may have to abandon a $150 billion clean energy plan due to resistance from a senator in his own party. China is the world's largest source of total emissions, but it's unclear whether the Chinese President Xi Jinping will attend the conference in person. At the time of recording, Australia is still in deep debate and is perhaps edging towards a net zero by 2050. Something that some have described as merely the ticket to entry to these kinds of negotiations. So as we approach COP26, there is very little certainty about the directions that discussions will take at that event. There is great uncertainty about the position of a number of countries, including Australia. And so today on the pod, we're joined by two of Australia's leading climate change and policy experts to discuss what's at stake and what we might hope to achieve through COP26. I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm Professor of Public Policy here at the Crawford School, and I am delighted to be joined once again today by my pod buddy, Anna-Greta Hunter. Hi, Anna-Greta.
Hi, Sharon. How are you? I'm Anna-Greta Hunter. I'm a cardiologist and physician, and I'm the Human Futures Fellow for the College of Health and Medicine here at the Australian National University. Policy Forum Pod is produced by policyforum.net. It's part of the Crawford School of Public Policy. The Crawford School is the Asia Pacific's leading graduate policy school. You can check out the degree programs and short courses that are available through Crawford at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. Sharon, in recent episodes, we did speak to two experts on the impacts of rising temperatures globally, particularly the impact of heat and particularly in the Australian context. How did you find that conversation? I found it really has resonated and continued to percolate in my brain as I consider what the future might look like.
Yes. To be completely honest, Anna-Greta, I found that an incredibly confronting conversation. Now, I think we said immediately after that pod, how difficult it is to hear what the impacts will be. Now, we hear the discussions about a rise of 1.5 degrees or perhaps up to 3 degrees. And I think for most of us, we don't appreciate what impact that is going to have. But when we heard Simon and Sarah talking about the impacts on human health, the impacts on the ecology around us, it really is terrifying. But these are conversations we really have to have. And so I thought that was an incredibly important pod.
Absolutely. And I think it helps to set the scene for today's discussion. So listeners, again, we apologise for our remote recording sound quality. It's not quite the same as when we're in the studio together, and we are hoping that at some point in the coming weeks or months that we may actually be able to record podcasts in person. We apologise for animal sounds and the sounds of our homes and our environment around us.
I have to ask, Anna Greta, where are your chickens today?
I'm not near the chickens today, Sharon. I'm probably closer to a larger amount of urban noise today. So yeah, there's no chickens at my end. There might be the odd dog.
I think I'm quite attached to your chickens. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And so today we have two extraordinary guests with us. We have Professor Mark Howden. Mark is the Director for the Institute of Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions at the Australian National University. He's Vice Chair of the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change at the IPCC and a member of the ACT Climate Change Council. Mark's worked on climate variability, climate change, innovation and adoption issues for over 30 years. He's a major contributor to the IPCC since 1991, with roles in the second, third, fourth, fifth, and now the sixth assessment reports. And he shared, of course, the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with other IPCC participants and Al Gore. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Sharon. Good morning, Anna Greta.
It's great to have you with us. And beside Mark is Frank Diozzo. Frank is the Professor of Environmental Economics and Climate Change Economics at the ANU Crawford School of Public Policy, where he directs the Centre for Climate and Energy Policy. He's head of the energy part of the ANU Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions. He's the joint editor-in-chief of the journal Climate Policy and a lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change forthcoming Assessment Report and Synthesis Report. He's involved in a large number of policy research and advisory exercises, including as a senior advisor to Australia's Garno Climate Change Review and advisor to national governments, Australian state and territory governments. As an environmental economist, his research focuses on policy-relevant aspects of climate change, energy and broader issues of environment, development and economic reform. Great to have you with us, Frank. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good morning.
So, Mark Howden, can we start with you? Perhaps you might like to map out for us the climate science. What does the latest research tell us about what's happening to the planet?
I guess the latest is in the IPCC Working Group 1 report, which was released in August. And that showed that the human influence on climate was unequivocal. So it's no longer a matter of uncertainty. It's a matter of established fact. That it was not just global temperatures that are being influenced by humans, but also extreme events. So it's the things like the heat waves and cyclones which impact on us so severely. And that they painted out pictures of the different scenarios of emissions in the future and where they may lead us in terms of temperature and other factors. And those look pretty grim. At the moment, we're heading for a fairly significant temperature rise, and so something like around about 3 degrees. And to keep to the Paris Agreement goals, we have to head to less than 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial, and that's going to be a significant challenge. I think importantly to note that these two forthcoming IPCC reports, one on impacts and adaptation and one on emission reduction, the one that Frank's on, and they're coming out in February and March, and they start to paint out the solutions, I guess, whereas Working Group 1 essentially paints out the problem.
I wonder, Mark, if you could just tell us what the best-case scenario is and how much work would be required to achieve that from the IPCC report.
Yeah, there's various scenarios that the IPCC report presents, and the two low ones, the low and very low scenarios, are consistent, roughly speaking, with the Paris Agreement goals. And so the very low one has us going to essentially net zero by 2050 and then below zero, very substantially. And the 2 degrees one, the low scenario, has us going essentially net zero by 2070 and then below zero. So really importantly, both of those show that net zero is not the end point of the changes that we need to make, but actually a midpoint of the changes. And both of those require us to start having net reduction of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And really importantly, both of those scenarios, as well as the other higher scenarios, still had us reaching 1.5 degrees in the 2030s. If we keep on a high emission scenario trajectory, we may actually exceed 1.5 degrees this decade. So there's not much time to waste. And that message of decadal scale response needed is actually mirrored in the carbon budget, which essentially shows that if we keep on emitting at current levels, then we only have around about 10 years of emissions to go before we completely blow our carbon budget that's consistent with 1.5 degrees.
Frank, in the discussions around the climate emergency that we're facing, we hear a lot about countries going through an energy transition. Can you talk us through what that energy transition means and how important it is in global efforts to fight climate change?
Yeah, Sharon, that energy transition has in fact got underway. It's no longer a theoretical concept. And the good news against, you know, the ever diminishing carbon budget and all of those things is that it is now clear that, you know, taking carbon emissions out of the economy is a lot more feasible in practice than we would have estimated just 5 or 10 years ago. And so, even though the global carbon budget is rapidly shrinking, the opportunity to really turn the ship around have increased massively. And really at the heart of the energy transition globally is renewable energy. Used to be a very expensive option for creating energy relative to fossil fuels, and it is now a very cost-effective option. And so, you know, very famously, International Energy Agency declared this year that, you know, solar photovoltaic power is the cheapest form of energy the world has ever seen. And that's a fundamental game changer that allows us to globally decarbonize electricity supply systems, right? And so we will have electricity that is emissions-free or nearly emissions-free. And that in turn then allows us to electrify everything, as we say as a sort of a shorthand. That means displacing fossil fuel use in the majority of applications throughout the economy. And so that includes industry, that includes heating in homes and offices, and very importantly, that includes transport as well. So the electric car, the electric truck, electrification of trains, electrification of even shipping, for example, via hydrogen and hydrogen-derived fuels that are produced using renewable energy is becoming possible and is becoming affordable as well. And so that's the fundamental transition that we see that we're seeing get underway, the displacement of most of the global fossil fuel system with renewable energy and nuclear in some countries and places.
I mean, there's often very little good news when we think about the challenges we're facing around climate change. But perhaps, you know, when you describe the affordability of energy, it seems that many countries and many communities that currently live in energy poverty, particularly in the global south, may have access to energy in ways that they didn't when we were using fossil fuels and it was more expensive. But Frank, when you talk about those efforts that are underway globally, which countries are leading the way, and how are they doing it?
Look, we're seeing that very rapid uptake of renewable energy and electrification of aspects of our economic systems really throughout the world. Some countries are leading on particular aspects of it. Norway is the global leader in terms of the deployment of electric cars, for example, and is providing everyone else with a benefit there in terms of creating that demand that then, or part of the demand that then drives down production costs. China is very, very strong on deployment of electric cars as well. That rapid uptake of wind and solar power is something we see really across the world. The majority of energy sector investments these days, the majority are in renewable energy rather than fossil fuels, and that's a monumental change. And very, very important. Importantly, we see that uptake right throughout the developing world as well. And so this is something that really we did not, as analysts and scientists in this area, we did not expect to happen at quite this pace, because the expectation was that renewable energy costs would decline, but the mainstream of the analysis did not anticipate cost reductions would happen quite as rapidly as they did. And so the assumption was always that relatively strong policy interventions would be needed pretty much everywhere in order to drive the adoption of zero emissions options, right? And then a sort of a realist assessment would then say, well, we're going to see these kinds of strong policy instruments in some of the developed countries, but not across much of the developing world for quite some time to come. And so that's really the fundamental difference. If you think of India, for example, or an economy like India, where you still got a big task ahead in terms of energy provision and in particular electrification in rural areas, which is, of course, very highly developed, desirable, and in fact essential from a human development point of view. It enables all sorts of things: health, education, economic progress. Formerly you would have considered really only constructing an electricity transmission line and then running coal-fired electricity through it in a place that mines coal like India. Today, There's a live consideration as to whether you simply electrify outlying rural areas through standalone solar powered systems with battery backup for the evenings and mornings, and that is actually a commercially or economically viable solution now. And in many cases, this can actually be done more quickly than you would have been able to expand a fossil fuel fired grid, and so that's really very positive all around.
It is great to hear some of the good news about the energy transition that's occurring globally. Let's turn our attention now to COP26. Since coming into office, United States President Joe Biden has returned to the Paris Agreement and held his own climate summit early this year to try and galvanize world leaders around and ahead of COP26. Mark Howden, what concrete measures do you think the US president will be seeking at the COP26 conference coming up? And who are his allies in this?
Yeah, so I think the US will be looking for allies right across the board, and because there's a whole stack of geopolitics outside of climate change that come into play within any of these discussions. But historically, their allies have obviously been the UK and European nations who are actually already on track to similar or even more ambitious targets than the US is. And importantly, I think what he'll be looking for is very significant increases in commitments from those countries that already haven't made increased commitments. So, for example, the UK has already stepped up its commitments to emission reduction. So I think the concrete outcomes from them will be, other countries pitching in to similar extents, the 50 to 52% reductions that the US has committed to. And I think they'll also be looking for essentially sharing the burden of climate finance, so stepping up in terms of that finance for particularly for developing countries and particularly for climate adaptation that's been lagging for a while. And so I think there'll be a really significant pressure there. And as well, I think what we'll see is an increased building of various coalitions to take on climate change emission reductions in various ways. That would be business and governmental coalitions, amongst others. And we're likely to see significant action there in terms of methane. So turning our attention not just to carbon dioxide, but also to methane and other gases. And so that would be also, I think, a concrete outcome they're looking for.
And Frank, what do we need to watch for in terms of the things that stand in the way of those outcomes being achieved at COP? And what stands in the way of the kinds of coalitions that Mark talks about being formed?
Oh, lots can stand in the way. and that's, the key to it is really some geopolitical rivalry on the one hand in terms of the barriers. The other one is, of course, domestic politics. And we're so very, very familiar with that aspect of it is in Australia, of course, but it's a thing in many other countries as well. And so on the geopolitical rivalry The election of Biden, of course, changed the global atmospherics and preconditions for climate policy quite fundamentally, because you've got the still largest economy and second largest emitter of greenhouse gases suddenly on completely switching tack from obstructionism and disengagement to being a very active player in favor of strong climate policy. So a great, great positive. But, gone are the days where the US and China addressed together and in unison. And so, when you think back to 2014-15, there was, in fact, a US-China agreement on climate change that preceded the Paris Agreement, and that, one can reasonably guess in many ways made the Paris Agreement possible. Born out of the drastic cooling of the geopolitical situation in that regard, we haven't got that anymore. And of course, the domestic politics is always what, in the end, either makes or breaks a country's contribution to an international effort. And so, I guess we might want to talk a little bit about that in terms of how Australia's positioning in the climate talks on international climate change policy generally. And, Australia is, of course, not the only country where the domestic political positions influence what governments are prepared or aren't prepared to offer on international cooperation.
Frank, I think we'll come back after a very short break and delve into some of those domestic issues in more detail. As you say, these are absolutely critical, and it would be good to tease out some of the issues that we're grappling with here in Australia. So listeners, please don't go away. We will return with Frank Yotso and Mark Howden in just a moment.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
We've talked a lot on the pod recently about how we value different elements of our lives and society, and we've had a series of guests question and critique the importance we place on measures like gross domestic product. As we know, climate change is an issue that affects all our lives in many, many different ways. And yet, in Australia's political space, at times, it's been tuned to a very narrow economic focus. And just before the break, Frank was talking about the challenges that we face in terms of the domestic politics getting in the way of some of the outcomes that we need to achieve globally. Frank and Mark, you've both worked on climate change for many years. Frank, can I ask you, do you think that the economic argument is the way to achieve progress, or do we need to make climate change a broader discussion? Do we need different types of strategies for different audiences and perhaps moving away from the economic argument as the primary argument?
Oh, look, I think, Sharon, the economic argument will always be at the center of the big debates that actually affect the economy and future prosperity. I don't think there's any getting away from it. The problem, of course, with the so-called economic debate, as it often plays out in politics or in Australian politics in any case, is that very shallow, superficial economic arguments get instrumentalized, often as a pseudo-argument against change. And so tradition, very unfortunately, over the last decade or so in Australia has become to contrast some sort of hypothetical horror scenario of Australia taking very strong and very costly action to constrain emissions while no other country does anything much, right? And that's, of course, not a good outcome for Australia's economy versus some sort of, nirvana outcome where every worker in the fossil fuel industry miraculously finds a high-paying job in the renewable energy industry. And so that's not real economic analysis. That is more political rhetoric than anything else. But, at the core, there's a question about Australia's place in a zero-carbon world, right? We know that, unless things go horribly wrong, the world economy will decarbonize, right? And then, to a greater or lesser extent, we will have some extent of positive response to the climate challenge in that way, right? And the question then becomes, how can the Australian economy thrive in that context, right? That's the question to ask. And increasingly, we understand that Australia actually has wonderful opportunities in this, because we're essentially not constrained in any practical or economic sense in terms of the availability of affordable clean energy, wind and solar in particular, right? Geographic preconditions for that are as good as they are in any of the best places in the world. And Australia could be the place where a not insignificant share of future large-scale zero-emissions energy industries have their home, right? And that's not just the production of hydrogen, which everyone's talking about, but that could extend to the production of energy-intensive industrial commodities, including steel, produced in Australia to an extent using clean energy. And that's a very promising economic future.
So I've just got a slightly different view on that one. And I sort of distinguish the economic arguments, which do play out very strongly in the policy and politics of this. But I think if you actually look at the average Australian, and the average Australian does want more action on climate change, so up to 90% of Australians want more action on climate change, and they're not really driven by those economic arguments in the broad. I think that they're actually driven by a much broader concern about climate change and the consequences this will have in the long term for Australia. And part of that is the economics, but part of it isn't. It's part of, what will happen to our reef, what will happen to our livelihoods, what will happen to our biodiversity, and et cetera. And so though I think there is a distinction, I think, between the public concern, which is much broader, and the politics of this, which is much narrower and focuses on that economics and investment side of things. And perhaps it also reflects a difference between the politics and the economic arguments often being very focused on the short term, whereas the public discourse, I think, does focus a lot more on the long term and the intergenerational side of things. And so, for example, the climate school kids and youth activism in terms of climate change is not fundamentally driven by the economics. It's actually driven by those broader concerns.
Mark, the Australian government, or some of the debates within the coalition at the moment, are very much focused on economics. Although, as you point out, many people within the public, and particularly younger people, are concerned about a much broader range of issues. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts on what is likely to play out for Australia at COP. As we mentioned in the introduction, there's debate in Australia. There's been some discussion around net zero emissions by 2050, but it's not clear that will even be agreed domestically. Mark, what's at stake for Australia at COP26, not just in terms of the environmental outcomes, but also diplomatically?
I think there's a lot at stake, which is in relation to Australia's reputation as a fair dealer, as an effective partner in terms of international activities, and in sort of our sort of status as a legitimate mid power. And so I actually think there's quite a bit sitting in there. And the fact that we may well go to Glasgow, or the PM may go to Glasgow without a net zero, you know, firm net zero commitment, and without a 2030 commitment that's different from our existing one, because the talked about projection is not a commitment, it's just a wish, as it were. And so I actually think that there'll be a lot of pressure placed on the Prime Minister over there, and by other countries, and also by big business. And that will probably be a very awkward and difficult place for the Prime Minister to be as a consequence. But coming out of that, if that does play out in that way, and if Australia doesn't respond, I think there could actually be some, you know, quite concrete implications for Australia. So for example, the discussions about carbon border adjustment mechanisms could come into play much more firmly, because other countries see Australia increasingly as a free rider in terms of those international agreements. Similarly, we've made a significant unfriend with the French over in the EU, and there's a series of consequences in terms of Australia's arrangements with the EU, including the free trade deal, which may suffer as a consequence. So you've got a combination of things which could pile up. And similarly, across the globe, I think the preparedness to engage with Australia as a nation that does the right thing could actually be damaged if we don't step up.
Mark, you've just described the 2050 target and the challenges we seem to be having in agreeing in Australia to a net zero target by 2050. But you also touched earlier on the concept of a carbon budget. How important is it for us in Australia and for the world generally to be thinking about a 2030 target more than the 2050?
The 2030 target is actually the main game at this point in time. And if you actually look at the Paris Agreement, it's the Paris Agreement goals in Article 2 is actually about the temperature targets. It's keeping temperatures well below 2 degrees and, if possible, down to 1.5. The emission reductions are a means to that end. So all of this discourse, which actually talks about net zero, almost treats net zero as the thing we're aiming for. Well, no, it's not. What we're actually aiming for is to keep temperatures down so we avoid dangerous anthropogenic impact on climate. That's what's under the UN Framework Convention. And so we need to start reframing this debate away from net zero, because, as I say, that's just a means, and towards the temperature goals and what's needed to achieve those temperature goals. And that means very, very substantial emission reductions by 2030 and earlier, because if we don't do that, we, as I mentioned before, we quickly blow our carbon budget that's consistent with 1.5 degrees. So if we keep on emitting at current rates, and it looks like we will, you know, the bounce back from COVID will probably take us to levels of carbon dioxide emissions very similar to or maybe exceeding the pre-COVID levels, which is around 42 billion tonnes a year. Then we chew up a big slice of that remaining carbon budget every year that we don't actually start to head downwards in terms of carbon dioxide.
So it's all about temperature. And listeners, I would encourage you again, if you haven't had a chance to listen to the podcast we did on heat, that really is that's the centre of the game here, is can we keep temperatures in a habitable zone for biological life?
So Arnabert, if you actually look at the Paris Agreement, essentially it's the headline goal is to strengthen the global response to climate change. And the three components under that are keeping temperatures down, adapting to climate change, and adequate finance flows to ensure that there's a pathway for all countries to head to a low greenhouse gas emissions and a climate adapted future.
So if we look beyond the machinations of the net zero target, Australia's climate policy has chopped and changed significantly over the past decade and a half. A major part of our government at the moment's approach has been a technology investment roadmap. Frank, how effective is the technology roadmap likely to be in bringing down Australia's emissions in the timeframe that Mark Howden's referring to?
Well, look, I mean, the so-called technology roadmap is essentially a list of a few technologies that are earmarked for government support of one form or another. And they're all things that are useful part of the picture. They're all things where, you know, further R&D and deployment will be useful in the coming decade or two, right? But they're not the main game. And the main game is deployment of technologies that are available and that are increasingly affordable as well, right? And so, you know, Australian climate policy for quite a number of years now has, at the federal level, almost entirely ducked the question of deployment for all the known reasons of, you know, political fights over this and the desire to protect established structures, in particular in the fossil fuel based industries, et cetera, et cetera. And so, if we're going to see a bona fide roadmap and action towards towards significant steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, right, then, you know, the technology roadmap will become a very minor part of the overall picture, and the overall picture will need to consist of providing incentives and also regulatory mechanisms and also government investment right throughout the economy to really grab all of those low-hanging fruit for reducing greenhouse gas emissions and for putting a whole ship into a low-carbon direction in medium to longer term.
We've mapped out throughout this discussion some of the challenges, environmental, economic, and diplomatic, that we'll be facing all leaders at COP26. I'm interested to hear from each of you how confident you are that we will see progress, and indeed major progress, at COP26. Mark, can we begin with you? Are you confident that we might see some positive shifts coming out of this forum that we're about to embark on?
Oh, look, I think we will see positives. We'll see more countries stepping up in terms of emission reduction commitments. And I think we'll see increased finance flows. So there'll be commitments to finance and adaptation. A couple of the areas where we may not see so much progress would be the global carbon market mechanisms, which is under Article 6. And there's particularly entrenched positions on that, which relate to the integrity and transparency and accountability of that system. So this is where we can essentially do carbon trading across national borders. And so I think that would be a very useful step in terms of getting some global action, but I don't think that will happen. The other aspects of that include whether there's likely to be significant step up in terms of the adaptation agenda. And I think what we'll see is increased pressure to report on adaptation actions from different countries to the next COP. And so that will, I think, be an important step up, because at the moment the adaptation side of the picture gets ignored because so much of the attention is being paid on the emission reduction.
And Frank, what is your thinking in advance of COP? Are you confident that we will see some positive changes, and what are the challenges likely to be?
Yeah, I agree with Mark's assessment there completely. This is not one of these negotiation sessions where it's a make or break question as to whether a particular agreement gets signed or a particular issue will be resolved or not, right? It's more the kind of meeting where leaders get together to announce greater national ambition. That's the main point of it, actually, right? And where nations reassure each other that they're serious about implementing the goals that were agreed in 2015 in Paris, right? But that's the main goal, and the main effect of it is on the domestic politics of it, you know. And so, you know, all of the tectonic shifts potentially that we're seeing within the Australian government at the moment, with all the difficulties that creates, right? Those shifts would very likely not have happened, not this year anyway, without COP looming as a marker on the road, where nations need to stand up and say, you know, this is how we're going about the pledge that we signed 6 years ago. So that's the main purpose. And, you know, looking ahead, there's the global stocktake of how we're actually going with the implementation of the Paris Agreement. there'll be some substance in that in terms of the actual UN-led taking stock of where we're at, where things are going well in terms of reducing emissions, and where things are not going well and where more action is needed, including at the individual national level. So, you know, in a sense, Glasgow kicks off that kind of process.
Mark and Frank, this is a conversation that we could continue for many hours, I think, and a conversation that we probably should continue for many hours at least, but we will need to draw this part of the conversation to a close. We normally like to close by asking our fabulous guests for their main piece of advice. And as we close this conversation and we think about some of the debates that are happening within Australia, can I perhaps ask you each for the one piece of advice that you would give and probably do regularly give to policymakers and leaders in Australia as we go into COP26? Frank, perhaps we could start with you.
Oh, look, that's, of course, a wonderful opportunity if you were asked for that kind of broad-ranging advice to someone in a position of policy influence. The big picture advice I would give is make sure you don't get stuck in the past with the analysis that you look at to underpin your policy decisions. Be aware that this is a rapidly changing environment in terms of the technological and economic opportunities. Let us not fall behind on this, and be aware that this is one of the defining global challenges that our country needs to actively be part of a solution. That's what I would say.
And Mark?
Thanks, Sharon. I guess I would say listen to the science. The science is incredibly clear now in terms of the need for action to avoid the unwanted climate changes that would be really concerning for Australia. I think listen to the public who overwhelmingly want more action on climate change. I think it's really important for governments to be forward-looking, to be strategic, and to be proactive in terms of responses to climate change on both the emission reduction and adaptation side, and really importantly, to take a national interest perspective rather than a more partisan or sectoral perspective.
I think they are amazing pieces of advice that I do hope our political leaders take heed of as we go into COP26. Frank Yotso and Mark Howden, thank you both so much for joining us today. This has been such an important conversation, but I think also a very helpful conversation for our listeners in terms of making sense of what it is that's at stake at COP26, what those discussions are going to be around, and what we can hope to see going forward. So thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Anna-Greta, and thank you, Sharon.
Thanks, Sharon. Thanks, Anna-Greta.
And listeners, thank you for joining us on this episode today and on every episode. As you know, we love to hear from you, so please do reach out to us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, that's at APPS Policy Forum, or via email on podcast@policyforum.net. Probably the easiest way to stay in touch with us is through our Facebook group. You can just type Policy Forum into the search bar and you will find us there. We would love you to subscribe and to leave a review on whatever platform you normally pod with. We read them and we take them seriously and we love to hear from you, so do leave us a review. And for anyone who's interested in hearing more, the ANU Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions, together with King's College London, have been collaborating on a short podcast series called COP26, We Got This. You can find that on Acast and on Spotify, and we'll also leave a link in our show notes. That's a fantastic podcast series, so do have a listen. Now, sadly, my pod buddy, Anna-Greta Hunter, has just dropped out. This is one of the great joys of recording remotely that we keep talking about. So Anna-Greta's internet has either let her down or she's gone to feed her chickens. I'm not sure which, but we won't be having our usual chat at the end of this podcast. We will be back next week, of course. From me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.